This is GamesAtWork.biz with Michael Martin and Michael Rowe, your weekly podcast about gaming technology and play. The thoughts and opinions on this podcast are those of the hosts and guests alone and not the opinions of any organization which we have been, are, or may be affiliated with. This is episode 292, Elite British Gaming. Good morning, good evening, good afternoon. Michael Rowe here on a wonderful Friday afternoon with some exciting topics to talk about today. Mainly one exciting topic, but we'll get to that shortly. I want to introduce my friend and co-host, Michael Martin. How the heck are you?
I'm doing fantastic, Michael. I'm glad you are as well. And I am super delighted that Andy Piper is once again with us today on this most momentous of occasions. Andy, how are you today?
I am doing well, thank you, Michael. Yeah, it's a delight to continue to be an occasional co-host, interjector, general troublemaker on the podcast.
Interlocutor,
exactly. And I'm most excited. I am genuinely excited, and I expect that as we go through the conversation over the next half hour or so, it'll become extremely apparent why I'm excited to introduce our special guest for this particular podcast. We don't often have special guests, unless you count me, and I'm definitely not special. Or a guest. I'm just, as I say, just kind of some kind of lurker. Mark Moxon. And Mark came to our attention in the last, I guess, 3 or 4 weeks because he's been doing some very cool and very interesting stuff, which I'm sure we're going to hear about the passion that he's put into this around a very well-known game that started here in the UK called Elite. Mark, welcome to the podcast, and thank you for joining us, and thank you for I know we've sent you a ton of messages and DMs and things asking for like the most perfect audio setup, etc. So we appreciate it.
Well, no, thanks very much for inviting me. I hope you can hear me, that's all.
Yes,
I've got a thumbs up. That's a good sign.
The three of us can certainly hear you. So it's all down to Mr. Rowe and Martin after this to make sure that everybody else can. So Mark, hello. Tell me about you. Who are you? Where do you come from? What's your background?
So I'm currently a coder. That's what I do for a living, building websites in a fairly corporate way. So that was that conversation. Let's move on. in terms of my real life, I've got a history from the Acorn market. I used to be editor of Acorn User magazine back in the 90s, which is a long time ago. So this predates all of the current internet stuff. But that means I've been using Acorns forever. I basically grew up with them, got my dream job in the 90s, and then decided to move into the web. So that's my kind of background. And that's one of the reasons why I've been doing this project that we're going to be talking about today, because I just have always lived and breathed Acorn machines. I did start out with a ZX81. Let me put that one in there. So that was the original. That was the first one in 1981. So I guess I've basically been coding for, hang on, what's the maths? That is nearly 40 years, isn't it? Okay, great. So started out with that.
Yeah. So yeah. Funny thing is, I said to my wife when this evening that we're going to watch Micromen, the BBC documentary about the Sinclair BBC wars, because she's never seen it. She's originally from the Midwest in Ohio. I'm going to subject her to Micromen, because I grew up in the 80s, and I definitely bought many copies of your magazine.
great.
My first computer was an Acorn Electron. That I remember sitting on my, in fact, I think I've written a blog post about this. I remember sitting on my parents' living room carpet, plugging it into the CRT TV. Elite was not my first game. We'll be talking about Elite shortly. But no, I mean, Acorn, I think for our podcast listeners who may not all be from the UK or from Europe, we should maybe put a little bit of context around this. There was a company called Acorn that went into partnership with the BBC and ended up producing massive numbers of 8-bit computers for schools across the UK, the BBC Micros. They also had a one that I mentioned called the Electron. There was another one called the Atom. And I ended up growing up, my first business was an Acorn RISC PC. Now, Acorn evolved into something called Acorn RISC Machines and then Advanced RISC Machines, and that's now a longer period of time. But it's been pretty exciting stuff to follow, and I've always had a very soft spot and warm spot in my heart for those systems. So hopefully that gives some context. I know a lot of people will have grown up with Ataris and Amigas and Sinclairs and PCs and other things. So that's where we're coming
from. TI-99/4As.
Right, we're coming from we're coming from that period of time. So Mark, it's wonderful to hear that you're a coder, and presumably I was about to say still a coder. I mean, presumably you've been coding for a long time. What about you and Elite? How did you get into this?
Well, I mean, I bought it in 1984 when it came out on the cassette version, and I was 14, and absolutely that's nice. The perfect time to get addicted to this kind of thing. And I just fell in love with it instantly. It's the most unforgiving game. If anybody, you should try it. It's really, I mean, it's still a fantastic game, but it's harsh. You die quickly. And I died quickly because I actually discovered that the middle part of my manual was missing. So I had no idea how to dock or fight or anything like that. And I still fell in love with this game until I actually got a replacement manual and discovered how it worked. And I was addicted to it. It's the only game I've really been addicted to. I still play, and I play Elite Dangerous these days because it's basically Elite modernized, and I'm in love with it. And I'm in VR, and it's exactly what I, as a 14-year-old boy, dreamt would be the future, and it is the future, and it still blows my mind. So I've been a fan since it came out. I didn't really manage to play the sequel because that was on a PC. Or an Amiga, so Elite 2 Frontier. I skipped that one.
Yes.
But really, I mean, I still have on my wall behind me. I have the ship identification chart from Elite. You know, it's great.
Amazing.
Sort of
sweet.
All bitmap stuff. So cool. It's been in my life for a long time, and I still. It's one of those games where you just think, yeah, that's a really fond part of my life. You know, you can bond with certain games at certain times of your life, and I just have great memories of playing that at home in the holidays. Just loved it, and still and was blown away by it, as people were, I think, you know.
I agree with you. Let's again just very, very, very quickly put some context around this. Elite was a game by Ian Bell and David Braben, developers here in England, that originally came out on the Acorn platform, was quickly ported to many other platforms. Mark, you will keep me honest if I'm speaking any lies here, please. I remember loading it from a cassette tape onto an 8-bit computer. It was it's a game that back in the mid 1980s, as Mark said, 1984 when it came out, used wireframes to kind of simulate sort of three dimensions, or what we now, you know, every game that we play now on our consoles and our phones or whatever, if it's chosen to be some sort of three-dimensional thing, has a sense of three dimensions, or more, or VR, as Mark was just alluding to. But Elite was really a remarkable piece of work for 1984 in terms of how it represented those three dimensions. I believe, and again, Mark, you can shout me down if you want to, and if I'm making my mistakes, your default name was Commander Jameson.
That's right. Yep.
And you were given a ship, and you were sent just into the void. I mean, there was no, like...
There was no hand-holding. That's right.
There was no goal.
You either liked that or you didn't. And you know, that's still the case with the modern one. They kind of drop you in it, and that's part of the charm, really.
And it was also the other thing that I very, very specifically remember about Elite when it, in the 1980s, was that you both, you had like a fairly big sort of almost VCR-sized or probably bigger case for the cassette, which came with the manual, and it also came with a novel. Sort of the background to the game, which was also, you know, world building. You know, it was this whole thing. I'm ashamed to admit, as a gamer since then myself, that I have not fully embraced or dived into Dangerous, but I read very good things about it all the time. So how did you get into this kind of archaeology? So Mark, you've got, tell us about this project. Give us some background.
It all started with lockdown. Okay, it's been, you know, this is the silver lining to this dreadful cloud. In that I found myself obviously with lots of people the world over, shut in the house and thinking, what do I do now? Retrenched from work, you know, not working.
Whatever it's called, yeah.
Wondering what to do, and I just was wandering around on the web, and I stumbled across a thread on Stardot, which is a BBC, an Acorn user's forum, in which a very clever guy called Kieran had published a GitHub of the original source for Elite that you could build on a modern computer. Now, Ian Bell, who, as you said before, was one of the authors of Elite, he released the original source code some time ago on his website. So this is a bunch of BBC Basic programs that when you run them, they generate the finished Elite game. So it is the source code of it, but it's incredibly terse because it has to run on a BBC Micro and produce this game that only just fits into the computer. There are no spaces in it. There's no comments. It's, you know, it's 6502 assembler. And it's, I mean, when I first came across it, I thought, fantastic, I'm going to be finding out what, how this game worked. And I loaded it up and just thought, I have absolutely no idea what's going on at all. It just didn't help. I just thought, wow, okay, this is way too clever for me. But Kieran had taken this and formatted it properly and got it assembling in a modern assembler. So at least that process could be run on a modern PC. Modern Mac in my case. So I thought, that's great, let's try that out. And it worked, and I could build Elite on a modern computer and that's then insane. Run it in an emulator or on my BBC Micro that's sitting right next to me right now. And I thought, that's fantastic. And as a coder, I thought, great, come on, this has got to be the way to understand how it is, because I can go in and I can change bits and see what it does. And then I thought, well, the bit that I really was interested in, and this is quite a nerdy part of Elite, is one of the things it was famous for. It's not really a thing to do with the gameplay, but it's the screen mode. What they managed to do was reprogram the display chip in the BBC Micro, the 6845, which is quite a popular 8-bit micro display chip. They managed to program it so that the top sort of three quarters of the screen were in a high resolution monochrome, and then the bottom kind of dashboard quarter was in four color with bigger pixels. So you could have a colored dashboard with all the kind of indicators and lines and stuff that didn't really suffer from blocky graphics, but then the high res mono space view in the top. And it was mind-blowing that they could do this. I mean, Acorn at the time said that this was the game that couldn't have been written because they didn't even know this was really possible. And the way it's done...
Mark, hang on a second. Yeah. What you're saying is that the developers for this game were able to segment it in such a way that they were getting high res and part of the display because they were able to efficiently write the code to take advantage of the graphics chip to do that and then leave the low res text stuff at the bottom.
Yeah,
is that what you're saying?
That's exactly right. So you had this space view at the top, which is black and white. And of course, everybody knows space is black and white anyway.
Of course.
It still should be, really, you know.
Exactly.
And that's black and white top. And then you've got a colored dashboard where you can show, you know, red indicators and green indicators and all this stuff. And it's genius the way they did it. And I mean, to quickly run through it, is basically they set a timer so that as the screen was being displayed, which it gets done 50 times a second, yeah, and you've got the cathode ray moving across and down, they worked out how to set a timer so the timer would go off when the cathode ray hit the top of the dashboard, and at that point jump to a routine that reprogrammed the number of colors and the size of the pixels in the 6845 so that as it then did the rest of the screen, it was in a different color scheme and pixel size, and then it flipped back to the top. And it was mind-blowing. And I thought, like, I really am interested in finding out how this was done. So that was the kind of the first thing I aimed for, and it took, you know, there were hints from others online. There was a guy who'd documented quite a lot of the internals of Elite, but in an incredibly sort of terse way. They were more like notes, but these were like little, you know, breadcrumbs I could follow and think, right, and this, and point to this and point to that, and eventually worked out how this one particular routine worked. And then I thought, yeah, if I can do this, I can probably do some more. And that was the kind of way in. And of course, because I was sitting around with nothing to do, and it was quite nice to have an escape from you know, the TV project. News and everything. And yeah. What better than to choose something from 1984? I mean, how apt. So you know, I got dived into the code and sort of moved on to all the other bits that I was fascinated in. I mean, how on earth do you simulate an entire universe in an 8-bit micro?
It's amazing. And yeah, there were other games that came out while I was that were developed while I was a very passionate Acorn user. And I'm still a very passionate Acorn supporter. I think, you know, that company arguably or definitely pioneered RISC computing and created the games and the technologies that I've grown up with. So it's very difficult for me to disconnect myself, especially as a Brit, but either way. It's remarkable that they were able to do this stuff by, you know, going down to the chip level. Now, as a young coder, as a young developer, I was 8 years old when this game came out, to date myself. But when I was a teenager, I had a RISC PC and another Acorn computer and sold software for that on RISC OS. But I assumed wrongly that this might have been written in BBC Basic. You've mentioned Basic, Mark, and but to look at your website and to look at the code and to look at all the work you've done, I mean, clearly that wasn't the case. You even mentioned that the very early stuff was written on the Acorn Atom, which was an extremely early kind of proto BBC Micro. It's incredible. How did you approach, like, I mean, I assume that you used to know 6502 assembler.
I did, I did, but only in kind of passing. I mean, I learned it because that's what you do. You have a computer, you know, you're a teenager, you learn stuff, right? It's interesting. So I picked up a book on 6502 assembler and read it and thought, great, but I didn't have a project, you know, and that's how you learn stuff, isn't it? You have a thing to build. But I learned it and I thought, that's interesting, and then really continued to program in BASIC, because the BBC BASIC was a particularly good dialect and was very functional. And I built my stuff in that, and that kept me happy. But then when I went to university, I was lucky enough to be able to buy an Acorn Archimedes, which was a RISC OS machine. Yeah? So I bought this, which is behind me as I speak. Love it. Still a great machine.
Oh, there we are.
Absolutely brilliant.
Nice green screen.
No, it's color. That's a multi-sync color. This is a 1989 model, I think. So it's kind of, you know, so it's pretty. So it's an ARM. It's ARM-based. Fantastic. So I learned ARM assembler. Yeah. So that in there was an ARM 2, and it's now got an ARM 3 in. So it's pretty hardcore. And I learned ARM assembler, and that really was where I got into assembly language, because that ARM assembler is a beautiful assembly language. It's simple and powerful, and which, you know, is the point. It's a RISC chip. So That's what really fired me into loving assembly language, and I built cool stuff, you know, bouncing graphics stuff, and just nothing. I mean, I was a student, you know, I mucked around, but it was really inspiring. I loved it, and of course, then I moved into having a job, and you know, you don't really program in assembly language in a job.
So, yeah, I was going to ask you that, Mark, and sorry, earlier I was having some audio problems, so I didn't hear it. If you did assembly for the day job, or was that just the hobby part? Because to me, when I taught myself C, I started saying, well, maybe I could learn assembly, right? And I would take C and I would export the assembly code and try to learn assembly from that. And it's just so foreign still in my brain. So I'm always amazed at people who dig down into the assembly code and how you got started and things of that nature. So
the thing, I mean, that going from modern, so I'm a web developer really, or a back-end web, I mean, come on, you know, full stack, make it up. We all make it up, don't we? But you know, any of those.
You do a lot of work. I know what the title means.
Did I just give it away? But there is no call for assembly language these days in anything other than embedded systems that have very specific requirements. I mean, how many levels of abstraction are there that we work with now? So the thing that really blew my mind about going back to this project was I had to remind myself how 6502 assembler worked. And it's so simple. There's so few instructions. Even though that's not a RISC machine, it's still, you can, you know, it fits on a couple of sides of A4, and the different versions of all the instructions, the different indexing things, they're really simple. So it's a bit like an old school box of Lego, right? It's, you know, it's like just the bricks, and they come in certain sizes. None of this fancy new stuff that's all, you know, like molded and,
all,
you know,
predefined kits and
this
stuff.
I'm talking about 1970s Lego here, you know. Yeah, so there's... Yeah, it's about what you do with the bricks, you know, and that's what assembly language is like. And you can build astonishing things from those, and you can understand every single instruction. Not only that, you can understand the machine that it's running on. Now, this is really novel. When you're used to working with, you know, modern systems, you don't even understand what half the team are doing. You know, that's how these things work. And that's okay. That's modern software development, and that's how you make your money. But in terms of satisfying nerd level engagement with hardware, this wins, you know, this really wins. Yeah. So, I mean, you know, to break it right down, the 6502 processor, which is at the heart of the BBC Micro and loads of other really popular machines, you know, that was a really popular one. It doesn't even have microcode inside it. And microcode is what, you know, almost all processors use these
first
days.
First level abstraction.
Yeah, exactly. That's the first level abstraction. So it takes your instruction that you're pumping in through the chip legs, and then it breaks it down into microcode and then runs the microcode. The 6502 doesn't have that. So literally, when I'm looking at an instruction in, say, the Elite source code, that literally represents the electronic signals that go into the chip and do stuff. You know, this is really primeval compared to what we're doing. And I'm looking at the source code for a program that implements an entire universe in my head, right? When I was 14, I lived in that universe. I flew around. There's all these systems and planets. And it's done.
It's Tron.
You know, it's absolutely it is. And so as I was going through this code, I was thinking, this is how it's done. It's, I mean, it's quite sort of existential stuff, this, you know, if you think about it. They built a universe in a tiny little computer that is so simple that you can understand it. Wow, that's amazing. And I felt like I was just walking in the, you know, footsteps of giants.
Was it a complete universe, Mark? I mean, for those of us that didn't have familiarity with the game itself, you know, was it like defined planets and Easter eggy sort of spaces where there were people who said, hey, did you do this in this sector and could you find it? Was it that level of defined universe?
Well, it's kind of smoke and mirrors because it's a tiny micro, it's all procedurally generated. So it's really... actually, the routine that generates this stuff is tiny. It's only about 20 lines long, if that. It's really bizarre.
Wow.
It lives in each system. There are 8 galaxies, and there are 256 systems in each galaxy.
That's a funny number. 256.
Yeah. Nice round numbers.
Interesting. Yeah.
And, I mean, they could have generated more, but they chose this particular batch. And the way it works is you have... let me see, 6 bytes. So it's 3 16-bit words, all right? Mm-hmm. that define each system, and the everything to do with the system is taken from those words. There's the, you know, the bits that define the radius of the planet, the you know, what type it is, whether it's industrial or agricultural, whether it's poor or rich, all this sort of stuff, even what the type of planet looks like. There's loads of stuff that comes from these words, and the way that they generate an entire 256 systems is they have a process called twisting that takes these three words and twists them, and it's basically a sequence, and it's the Tribonacci sequence, which is very similar to the Fibonacci sequence, which is when you add the previous two numbers, but you add the previous three numbers, right? Tribonacci, okay. Apparently that's what it's called, and it's a riff on this. So basically what you do is you take one set of seeds, they're called, mm-hmm. and that's the first, that's planet zero in your system, in your galaxy, and you run this twisting process, which is very quick because it's only adding stuff, and you can do that really quickly on an 8-bit micro, and you can generate each planet as it goes, and so it does this every time. And if you then change from one galaxy to another, because you've been able to afford a galactic hyperdrive, which is super expensive, what it does is it shuffles them all along within the bytes. Mm. You've got each byte within itself, it rotates it. So they can do that eight times and you end up back at the start. So that's why there's eight galaxies. So this entire universe, right, of all these 2048 systems, I think, if my maths is right. Yeah, sounds about right. Comes from one little number, okay, three 16-bit numbers, and a small routine of not very many instructions, which is really fast. And from that, all of this information comes. It's incredible.
And just imagine from that, we end up with No Man's Sky, right? Mm. Because it's fully procedural, small type code that generates based off of, you know, the size of an int within the hardware, the complexity that you can get to. So if you get to 64-bit, right, that's huge. Back then, not so much. And amazing.
Yeah. And it's what they do in Elite Dangerous now. It's just that it's on a much grander scale, and they kind of map it to the known galaxy. So in Elite Dangerous now, you're flying around the known galaxy, but all of the individual attributes of those are procedurally generated, but with a lot of nous about what's actually out there. Obviously on the BBC 32K version, this was, you know, a bit more. I mean, for example, the species are generated, and so there's, you know, and they're made up of adjectives, so you can get slimy, round rodents and stuff like this, and I don't know, there's a whole way of generating, and the names of the systems are also generated by going through four twists, and for each twist you pick a two-letter pair from a list of about, there's about 25 two-letter pairs, and then they all bung it together, and they wrote the two-letter pairs so that they would always work in sequence with each other. It's mind-blowing, it really is. I mean, these guys were at university, right, when they wrote this. They were at Cambridge, so like pretty clever guys. But like, what, you know, I'm looking at code from 1984 and thinking, this is astonishing. It really is astonishing what they achieved. It's inspiring. And it was really amazing just to be looking through this code. And this is, I mean, that's the most famous part of the code. But the thing is peppered with clever stuff. And it wasn't really documented to this level. I did feel certain areas it were documented. The twisting process has been known for a long time and is pretty well documented. But, you know, some of the stuff is just, I mean, it's just clever, really, honestly. Just makes you feel small.
It's insane because to Michael's point, you know, yes, No Man's Sky was, you know, the ultimate evolution in some ways of what Elite, you know, set out to deliver, but it was delivered on a cassette tape. it wasn't something that could be updated over some magical wireless internet cloud. It was delivered one time, and as you just said, Mark, you know, there was an algorithm that generated all the things. Remind me of the first planet. I'm forgetting. I know Commander Jameson. Was it begins with L?
Lave?
Well, it's interesting. It's Lave, apparently, but I Lave used to call it Lave. Like it had an accent on the, yes, on the E. Because back then,
on the second syllable,
there were no podcasts, you know, in 1984, and there's no YouTube, so you couldn't hear people trying to, you know, talk about the game. But apparently it's Lave. Right. So I had to relearn that when I started playing Elite Dangerous, because you sound weird if you've accidentally put an accent on the E.
It's just an old timer. Yeah.
No. Who knew?
So Mark, you've already outed yourself as somebody who's worked with, you know, 6502 Assembler and the platform for a long time. So, you know, when you got bored in lockdown and you had the opportunity to dig around, I mean, I'm curious, what skills or new skills in particular did you develop or use in terms of like this archaeology of this incredible game?
Well, I mean, probably the biggest skill was the ability to read 6502 Assembler
and understand it.
I mean, when I first started out, I was having to look it up a lot.
Yeah.
And, you know, and there are various, I mean, like in every language, there are various idioms that you get to know well, you know, and the big one is probably comparing values and then branching depending on whether things are greater than or less than, and they use carry flags and stuff like that. So it's, you know, you look at it and you think, okay, that's an if X is less than Y, jump here. Right. But when you're first doing it, you think, now what's that mean? And have to look it up. So I guess that's probably the biggest skill was that. But also getting into the mindset of how these guys wrote. It's very clean code. So it's quite easy to follow when you get, you kind of find that there's a point where you think, I'm kind of reading this now rather than having to work it out. And so you're more searching for the algorithm rather than understanding the language. And I think that's probably the tipping point where you're getting stuck into the archaeology, because, yeah, I mean, it's 6502 code. That's great. But that's a language that's known and used and understood. There's not much to discover there. But what people did with it, that's the interesting part.
It's the difference of reading a language and actually hearing it in your brain as you're reading it,
absolutely,
right?
Absolutely.
One is translation and the other is understanding.
That's right. And it's kind of like, I guess, when people are playing music really fast and singing at the same time, which is like,
yeah.
I don't know how they do that. I can't. But, you know, they're doing it. I guess it's like driving a car. You know, the kind of mechanics of it become a bit more subconscious and understanding what's going on. So that would have been a leap. But it was also, there was a point where, this is written by two people, right? In 1984, you didn't get two people writing one game. It really didn't happen very much. People were bedroom coders, you know?
Yeah.
And that's, you know, which was great because you could understand it. But these were two people, and also on two platforms. We've mentioned before that it's a lot of the code on this started out on an Acorn Atom, which was the precursor to the BBC Micro. And it was sophisticated, but not as sophisticated as the BBC. But for example, the label names in Assembly, you had to have them as a pair of letters followed by numbers. So the source code is full of labels like XX17 and QQ15 and stuff like this. And
not QQ15.
Oh, yeah, I know. It just crops up a lot. You know, TT27, which is one that crops up so much I still remember it, you know. And then the later code on the BBC Micro, because David Braben had an Acorn Atom, and he wrote mainly the ship drawing code, which is a very celebrated part of the game, and that got moved into the BBC Micro. So you can kind of almost see where the code base is emerging. So it's a bit like Sergeant Pepper, you know. It's like a day in the life where you get this amazing segue from, you know, the crazy kind of orchestral thing, and then it's a McCartney song,
and then you get that chord at the end where it all makes sense.
That's right. Yes, and it hit, and you think, this is it, and you can sort of see where it merges a little bit. I mean, on Ian Bell's site, he's actually listed who wrote what, which was really helpful in trying to look at this and go, that's interesting. I mean, one particular part is the 3D scanner, which is a really important part of the game. At the bottom of the screen, right? I mean, you know, you're flying around in space, you're shooting pirates, you haven't got time to try and decode a really complex dashboard. And they invented this amazing 3D scanner, which is like an ellipse on its side, tilted away from you, and the dots of the ships around you are above and below the ellipse, and they kind of have lines that drop down or go up onto the ellipse. So you can instantly look at it and go, I know where that ship is in space. Now, that's an incredibly clever thing to have designed, but it really nearly didn't make it into the game. It was a last-minute addition. They originally had a couple of square scanners. One was a top-down view and one was a side-on view. And that was really difficult to convert into a 3D map in your head. It worked, but was, to be honest, when you've got six pirates, you know, shooting you from behind and all this, you haven't got time for kind of that sort of stuff. And they were never really happy with that part of the game. And at the last minute, David Braben came up with the idea of this ellipse. And it really is you look at it and you think, God, that's a great idea. You know, that's one of those things you think it's so obvious when you see it.
Once
you think,
it's there.
That's it. That's the one. That's the one. And it was the last minute, and the game was pretty much about to be published. And so the story goes that they pitched the idea to Acornsoft, who said, yeah, look, that's brilliant. Let's put it in the game. And Ian Bell wrote the code, and David Braben wrote the program to generate this ellipse and get the graphic out there, and then they had to redo some of the pictures in the manual with the new thing and change it and get it out. So it literally slipped in. So that is a genuine, you can see where it's the amazing idea from one guy written by the other guy, while you've got the source code for the thing that generates the scanner is also available from Ian Bell's website. It's kind of the last bit. It's the last bit of the game, right? Then it got released and they became rock stars. And of course, life is different when you're a rock star. Everybody wants to have a piece of you and, you know, talk to you and stuff. But this is the last bit they wrote as kind of bedroom coders, I guess. And it's a really interesting nice. Part of the code. It's, you know, that's a real, that's where it, the sum of the parts is greater than the whole, and that's it. They're laid out in the code, and you think, yeah, that's clever.
I, to maybe update us a little bit to more modern times and possibly to what some of our listeners may be familiar with, and also I'm a huge geek and a 1980s nerd. I've been playing, I started to play Star Wars Squadrons, and which is... which I know that our friend Ian, ePredator, has been playing in VR, which I don't have the capability for. But either way, I've been playing it. It's really fun. But, you know, ultimately, even though that was a massive hack that you've just described, Mark, in terms of the, you know, the ellipse and the scanner, I mean, a lot of these games, you know, want to show you where your enemies are and you know, the orientation and all that stuff. So, yeah, no, I agree that that is an absolute classic. Mark, I should just say for everybody who's listening, because I didn't set up front, neither did you, but it's my fault, the results of your research are bbcelite.com. Which is a really cool site, especially for the very retro text, just because a lot of us are old school. I wanted to just update us, because we're moving along a little bit. You said you're a coder by profession. You've done all this cool stuff. I bought your magazine when I was a kid, so I'm an absolute, you know, worshipper already. Are you still a gamer? What kind of, are you still into that space, or are you very much on the technical side?
So I didn't really play games for a while. I was hooked on Elite when I was a teenager, and then didn't really play many games for a long time. I dabble a bit, but actually I'm not really a gamer. And then, and it sounds really, I mean, but Elite Dangerous came out in, it's what, 5 years ago? Something
five,
like that?
Yeah,
now?
5 or 6 years, I would say, yeah.
2004, yeah, something like that. And I was actually doing some traveling at the time. Me and my wife went through Central America, and that was great. And so I wasn't playing games, but I had to get involved in the Kickstarter. I just thought, look, this is it, you know? And it was like, bang. So I bunged some money into the Kickstarter, and don't regret a single penny. I have a space station I named. It's great.
Very cool.
So that was so I had access to the beta, or the alpha and the beta, but I was traveling with a MacBook Air in Central America. It doesn't really work very well, you know. So
sorry to interrupt. I had a very similar experience, because like you, as an Elite fan, the Kickstarter came out. I'm a Mac user, and I love the Braben and the Elite Dangerous folks, but I had a bad experience with my initial download or attempt to download of Elite Dangerous because I was on a Mac, and because, you know, lots of other things. So sorry to interrupt you.
You had to be into it back then.
I
had a similar thing. It kind of worked in a very, very slow way, but I kind of thought that this is great. I love this. I'm just looking forward to it. But really, I mean, when we got back from traveling and I had a Mac that I'd bought a few years before, it wasn't up to it. And it did reach the point where I thought, look, I love this game, and I need to get a PC. And for a Mac user, that's a leap, isn't
that's
it?
It's almost
really?
Sacrilege.
It is, but you know, hey.
Blasphemy.
So I built my own because that's the nerdy approach, and actually, yes. I loved it, and I highly recommend that as a fantastic thing to do. And yeah, look, it's Windows, but hey, Windows 10 isn't Windows 8, is it? It's not that bad. And of course, I got a VR helmet, and I just, you know, it completely blew my mind. I've been playing it now for a year and a bit, and then I put the helmet on, and I'm the 14-year-old boy who was obsessed with this game in the 80s, you know, and suddenly I'm in my spaceship, and I'm flying around, and it's epic, and it's still epic. I was playing it this afternoon. I love this game. I really love it. However, like all games, you know, there comes a point when you're into sort of four-figure hours on it that you probably think, yeah, I might have kind of done everything in this, you know.
Got a little bit overboard.
yeah. Well, I'm keen on this game. But the great thing is I have a great gaming PC, so I have branched out into others and, you know, played The Witcher 3, stuff like that, you know. Oh, yeah. And that has really, that has opened my eyes. So, me and my wife play games every day after work. I say I'll go downstairs and we'll plug in, and you know, we'll play adventure games or RPGs and stuff on the sofa. So yes, I'm much more of a gamer now, but I don't really think of myself as a gamer.
No. I understand that. So to reconnect us back, to sort of loop us around, if you were to project yourself, you know, 30 years in the future. From now and the games you're playing now, do you think that a similar project, you know, somebody would discover, for example, you've just mentioned The Witcher, just I'm picking that one because you mentioned it. Do you think that someone would be like poring over that kind of code and documenting it, and if they were able to access it?
If it's seminal stuff like that, definitely. I mean, why wouldn't you? Come on, but people are picking over albums from, you know, so long ago and going, wow, this is what they did. Surely it's interesting to people who are...
But let's think about it. I mean, Elite, you know, you had all the source code in one place, right? The source code to the entire thing in one place, right? Witcher, you're going to have all the different toolkits that they added in to build it. So how do you go back to that point, right? I mean, I'm just thinking the 14-year-old right now who's playing Witcher, right? And going, I should get into coding, right? And so they then start getting into a tool and they realize, well, I need design skills, I need graphic skills, you know, I need to have Unity, I need, right? And they get this toolkit that's, you know, 40, 50 different components, and then they can say, hello world.
Oh yeah. I mean, I can't imagine what it's like. I can't imagine what it's like for the source code for these things. You know, I'm a coder by profession, and I look at them and think, I mean, which is a great example. It just seems to go on forever.
Yeah.
And it is epic in every sense. Elite was epic because it was small and was epic. Yes. That was the amazing thing about it. It's like a, you know, it's concentrated epicness, but The Witcher's sprawling epicness, and I can't imagine how they have teams. Their teams are hundreds big, right? The coders who work on The Witcher haven't got their head around the source code. They've got their head around the bit of the source code that they're responsible for. I guess you're right. It's kind of difficult, but are you telling me that in 30 years, if someone stumbled across the Witcher source code, they wouldn't be picking it apart and looking at it? They would probably be doing digital archaeology as a team.
Yes.
You know, wouldn't you? I was able to do this with Elite because it is still the kind of level where one person could have written that. It happened to be two, and that's part of its magic. But, you know, people were pumping out games back then on their own. So obviously, by definition, they are things you can get your head around. Mm-hmm. But it would be... Yeah, I mean, wouldn't you like to see The Witcher source code and see what it's like and know whether it is something that somebody could get their head around in 30 years? Yeah.
I agree. And you know, we make assumptions because of where we've come from and how sophisticated things are today, that, you know, things will never get more complex. But we already know, because we look back, you know, things have got infinitely more complex. 32 kilobytes. I mean, that is an incredibly tiny, tiny amount of space. And yet that's what this game ran in. And it's very difficult to communicate to either modern coders, because I work with many, many developers today, who are just coming into the profession as engineers, software engineers, to my nieces. it's incredibly difficult to explain how things have changed, and it always will be. But I think you're right, Mark. I think no matter how complex all the situations that Michael's just described, at some point in the future, it will actually be quite easy to kind of like Tony Stark style, you know, sift through and in your virtual holographic display, you know, the source code and the things that you're actually interested in. I really wanted to, I heard you say these words yourself, Mark, but I just wanted to read them from your website. Because I think they're really they mean a lot to me, and they're very relevant. Elite is the coding equivalent of A Day in the Life, a mashup between the Acorn World's very own Lennon and McCartney, with results that are just as seminal in their field. They say you should never meet your heroes, but grokking their source code, well, that's another matter altogether. And Mark, you and I have just literally met this evening as we speak. But I'm a historian by background. I've told you already. I grew up on Acorn computers, but my degree is in history. A lot of this stuff is very meaningful to me. So I know that I really appreciate you having time and spending time to talk to us. And I know that Michael's and some of our listeners, or many of our listeners, if not all of our listeners, all seven,
both of our listeners,
all seven people, will really appreciate the fact that you've spoken with us, and that you spent so much time excavating, archaeologizing this stuff. Because for me, this is fascinating, and this is really, I've learned from you, even without having read, well, not without having read through your website. I did read through your website, but beyond having read through your website, some really interesting stuff today.
Well, thanks. It's been a great pleasure. You can hear I could talk about this all day.
So. No, I can definitely talk to you. I mean, as a fellow Brit and an Acorn user subscriber, well, I may not have been a subscriber, but I definitely bought a lot of copies of Acorn User. You and I could definitely enjoy a lot of catching up. Misters Martin and Roe, have you got any other things you'd like to talk to Mark about?
Oodles. But I think we're just about out of time, which is just the sad thing. It feels like we've only begun to scratch the surface here on the things that bind us together.
Exactly.
In ways that you only see when, as you said, Mark, you grok the code, you understand what people were actually doing. So my great thanks to you as well. Michael, I think we should probably end on a note of how can people find out more about this particular show? And also we'll include in the show notes the links to Mark's website too. But Michael, if somebody wanted to find out more about this particular show, what should they do?
Well, first, they would let me say, Mark, thank you. It's been an absolute pleasure talking with you this evening and learning about, the assembly code, the archaeology, and to paraphrase what Andy said, I dig it, man. I dig it, right? Digging into this code has been a blast. Just learning how you approached it and what you've learned from it and what we can learn from it. But people can go to bbcelite.com to learn all about what Mark has done, as both Mark and Andy have mentioned earlier. And if you would like to follow us, we are on Twitter at games@work_biz. Or at gamesatwork.biz out on the interwebs. We look forward to hearing from you and what you thought of this show or any episode that we've done in the last, I don't even want to say how many years, but it's pretty close to the age you were when you started on on playing Elite.
Have I been doing this since 1994? I feel like it, but no, I mean, this has been amazing.
So, thanks everybody, and thank you, Mark. Thanks, Andy. Thanks, Michael. And thank you all for listening, and we'll see you next time on gamesatwork.biz.
Bye. You've been listening to gamesatwork.biz, the podcast about gaming technology and play. We are part of the Blueberry Podcasting Network, and would like to thank the band Random Encounters for their song, Big Blue. You can follow us on Twitter at gamesatwork_biz or at our website at gamesatwork.biz.